14. The Death of Forbes McAllister. Cantankerous bon viveur Forbes McAllister had brought with him two of Lord Byron's duelling pistols, purchased in auction from under the considerable nose of Michael Winner. As I politely inspected them mid-interview, I discharged one, and the bullet penetrated and destroyed Forbes' heart. As with so many gunshot wounds to the heart, it proved fatal. I won't have been the first British chat show host to kill a man on air, and I won't be the last, but I make no excuse for what happened. I accept complete responsibility, and you'll not find me making mealy-mouthed excuses for what was a truly tragic event. What I will say is this. Forbes McAllister had led a long and full life, but with a diet rich in cholesterol and alcoholic booze, it's very probable that his health was failing. We can only speculate as to how badly his health would have deteriorated, or how painfully drawn out his eventual death would have been, because I ended his life in episode 6 of my chat show. Forbes, who may or may not have had a violent temper, was to be the final guest on my show. I remember in the green room before the show that he had incredibly sweaty hands. It's rare that I notice a man's palm piss, because my own inner hands tend to work up a torrent of clamminess straight after toweling, one of the many reasons why I often greet new acquaintances with a curt nod or a wave. But I thought, Jesus Christ, now they're wet. That should have rung an alarm bell, because although I didn't know it at the time, our perspiration would soon create a lethal lubricative effect, which, when combined with studio lights and a hair-trigger pistol, would blast a man's chest into kingdom come. And note that this in no way tallies with the findings of the coroner. These are my findings, not the Crown's. The show had been quite a strong one. It was certainly a little fruity. Of the 6 people on the sofa, 50% were gay. 2 lesbians and a gayman, although the gayman, Scott McLean, was only 10 at the time and probably unaware of his sexual trajectory. Scott has continued acting, but now stars exclusively in gay pornography. Fortuitously, he's grown into the spitting image of Richard Gere, so has made a lucrative series of films that pay sodomical homage to Gere's back catalogue, Gaze of Heaven, Pretty Man, and An Orifice and a Gentle Hand. Not on the sofa, but undeniably on the show, were Joe Beasley and Cheeky Monkey. Having Joe appear was my one big regret of this episode. I'd seen him in Bournemouth at Ho Seasons way back in 1979, before so-called alternative so-called comedy had been foisted upon the world. Joe was streets ahead of his time, writing his own material and bringing a fresh perspective to the art of stand-up comedy. Unlike alternative comedians, Joe's act, classy ventriloquism mixed with snappy one-liners, was mercifully unencumbered by the need to provide social commentary. Unless he represented the Tories, and the monkey whose rectum he forced his hand up represented coal miners or something. At Ho Seasons, he raised the roof. I saw members of the audience doubled over, desperately trying not to wet themselves. Afterwards, Joe modestly suggested that this was more to do with their age than his act, but I know good comedy when I see it. So I promised him I'd remember his name and give him a TV break as soon as I could. I honoured that promise on the 21st of October, 1994. I don't feel that Joe prepared properly for the show, and his act suffered as a result. I happen to believe that his joke about a Swedish Fred Flintstone is a quite beautiful piece of writing, but he struggled to remember its precise mechanics, and it slithered out of his mouth like a bad oyster. I stepped in to put him out of his misery. After about 90 seconds, I didn't kill him, or rather I didn't kill him. It has been an experience best forgotten, but shamefully in the years that followed. Joe did his best to trade on the disastrous TV appearance. He even attempted, unsuccessfully, to claim legal ownership of the sobriquet Troubled TV Funny Man when the whole Barrymore thing blew up. Lesson learnt, Alan. I've never given anyone a break since then. It's just not worth it. Joe never bothered to apologise. Not even through the medium of the monkey. But ignore that. This chapter is about Forbes McAllister, and I'd hate for my guests' unprofessionalism or sexual peccadilloes to detract from the solemn death of a good man. You have to say that. To be fair to myself for a change, Forbes had been a pretty awkward guest and had brought the pistols onto the show himself and had very sweaty hands and was making sudden movements and saying some pretty off-putting things about bagpipers. But as I say, no excuses. At the show's denouement, trust Mr. Professional here to time the slaying so it gave the show a neat conclusion, Forbes gave me his sweat-drenched guns to inspect and shocked me with a loud bark of, "Be careful with that!" One thing led to another, and a bullet led to his heart. I covered him with a plastic replica of my face and did my best to close the show. The two lesbians, Wanda Harvey and Bridie McMahon, went a bit hysterical. They'd been told to stick around on the sofa until the credits rolled, but when Forbes remains slumped in their general direction, they bolted in a pretty craven attempt to spoil the series' sign-off. For that, I've never forgiven them. It was a bit of a blur after that. My producer, Rupert Summers, lost his head and said a few mean things to me. I let that go. He was in shock and needed help, not censure. Then I looked over to where a policeman was putting the pistols carefully into a transparent freezer bag. Those flippin' guns, I thought. I hated them just then. In the intervening years, I've received a great many letters from gunsmiths who've said that the greatest professional sadness a gunmaker endures lies in spending hours perfecting the release mechanism of a flintlock pistol, only for a collector to display it ornamentally. This was exactly what Forbes had in mind for them. I had at least prevented that. I always think that, like a dangerous dog sinking its teeth into the waddling rump of a fat postman, a pistol must experience the bittersweet bliss of fulfilled destiny at the moment of discharge, before, quite rightly, being destroyed. At least, my gun-making friends seemed to suggest Lord Byron's beautiful and ballistically awesome pistols were allowed to perform the task for which they were painstakingly created, killing a man. This was reality TV, before the term was invented, real and raw, and red in tooth and claw. Peter Bazalgette of Endemol fame is sometimes wrongly credited with the invention of reality TV. It's a little-known fact that Peter's grandfather Joseph designed the London sewer network. Some people have very unkindly suggested Peter has simply taken what his granddad did literally and continued it metaphorically, delivering an unending torrent of human filth and waste into our homes. But I'm not one of those people. I think he's quite good and has made a reasonable contribution. No, the person who really invented reality TV was I, Partridge. I've been asked many times what happened next, when the camera stopped rolling and the audience filed out. What happened to Muggins here? Well, I'll do my best to describe it. For added drama, I'll be slipping into the present tense, but I don't want to suggest in any way that this took place anything other than a long, long time ago.
"Why did you do it, huh? Why the F did you do it, Partridge?"
A bad-breathed copper shouts in my face, and I turn my head away from what I think is the odour of Walker's smoky bacon, which I usually quite enjoy.
"What's your motive, Alan?" says a woman detective constable. "What's you kill him for?"
I'm in a dark, dank room, deep in the nick, handcuffed like a common criminal. A strip light flickers and buzzes as a rat scuttles across the floor. The woman detective constable screams in frustration and slaps me across the face. My eye closes up, but I look back at her defiantly. The interrogation goes on for ages. "Please," I hear myself say. "I've told you all I know. Can I please just go home? I'm doing a store opening at 10 for World of Leather." "The only thing you'll be in tomorrow is a world of trouble," says the copper, a line that even at the time I thought was pretty good for someone who probably didn't get any A-levels. Truth is, there is no store opening. With negotiations for a second series of KMKY going well, I have two other meetings the next morning that could shape my career. A current affairs show for a soon-to-be-launched TV channel from the mind of Kelvin McKenzie, alongside Derek Jameson, and a quiz show for Maltese Television that was based on Blockbusters. Both meetings are slated to take place in the same branch of Harry Ramsden's. I need to be there. The interrogators don't let up, though. The torment lasts for hours before I'm thrown into a cold cell, and I pick myself up from the straw and filth. Through a hatch comes a tray of food. I paw at it listlessly until I notice that it contains chicken nuggets. And what chicken nuggets? These boast all the smoky zing of McCain's southern coating with the tenderest cuts of white meat. The beans are lukewarm, but not overcooked, and a generous dollop of smash adds a buttery finish that sets the plate off beautifully. To drink, a mug of steaming tea. A really, really good meal. My solicitor arrives. By his own admission, he's better equipped to handle employment tribunals than homicide, but it's a pleasure to see him. He's a massive fan of the show and insists that until the last 5 minutes it had been very good. I suffer the indignity of giving fingerprints. a relatively straightforward task that took longer than it should have because my hands were by now very, very sweaty and it was hard to produce a clear print. Once released into the glaring sunlight of the sun, I'm hauled into the BBC for crisis talks without a care for my other meetings. Hayes is quiet, and it's really hard to work out how he feels the series has gone. A health and safety officer has a lot to say, which feels like bolting the stable door after the horse has legged it in a hail of gunfire. As the exec producer, it turns out I have ultimate responsibility, which seems unfair to me, and I say so. We craft a press release, and then I arrange to meet Hayes to discuss not just a second series, but other potential projects. Everyone pipes up with, "For fuck's sake, Alan," as if my career should die just because Forbes has. Then I go home. People are quick to claim credit when things go well, but journalists' calls to the BBC were met with an officious, "Alan Partridge is not and never has been an employee of the BBC. He is a private contractor, and all such contracts are under constant review." The shooting of Forbes McAllister was, without question, the pivotal moment in my life. I often think it's like that film, The Sliding Doors, with Gwyneth Paltrow. But instead of the tube door shutting, it was a bullet fired directly into a celebrity's heart, not deliberately or recklessly. Even after all these years, I feel compelled to add that caveat. You know, there were two victims that day. Me, because of everything I went through. But Forbes McAllister is also a victim in a way, because, of course, he died.